Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. The United States and its new arch enemy, Canada, share the annual observance of Labor Day on the first Monday of every September. Perhaps another something in common is that despite the usual boilerplate about Labor Day as a celebration of labor, the real truth is that Labor Day is a painful reminder that the USA is deeply involved in a bitter, uncivil war between rich and poor, the oldest of class wars that pits the working class against the Brahmins of industry and Wall Street, the common enemies of honest democracy. And the workers of America are losing. I start today's program with a couple of diatribes I wrote for the North Coast Times Eagle. You might surmise that labor inequality is more pervasive and the rights of working people have not progressed since I wrote these screeds, and that the remedies proposed remain necessary. I start with labor's labor lost. And as I said, I wrote this and the following. Labor Day means little more than a final three-day holiday that ends the silly season. Once it celebrated working people, but now that is a joke. Unions don't march on Labor Day anymore, and the few who put on a show are merely window dressing. Andrew Levson wrote in The Working Class Majority that cliches about the USA as a classless society are, quote, exposed as hollow by the simple fact that American workers must accept serious injury and even death as part of their daily reality. Every year, 100,000 workers are killed or die of work-related accidents or disease. 40,000 are disabled and about 6 million are hurt at work. Imagine the universal outcry that would occur if every year several corporate headquarters routinely collapsed, crushing 60 or 70 executives, Levison wrote. Or suppose that all the banks were filled with noxious dust that constantly produced cancer in the managers, clerks, and tellers. Finally, try to imagine the horror if thousands of university professors were deafened every year or lost fingers, hands, sometimes eyes, while on their jobs. The power of American labor unions as a force to represent and protect the rights and persons, as well as jobs, in American industry has faded over the past decades. This erosion of social and political equity of people who produce the gross national products of the American market is due in part to an increasing global economy and to international competition and ease of capital flight. Union strike power is vulnerable to diversified mega corporations, especially in highly automated industries, and virtually powerless to halt overseas relocations. Union busting has decimated some of the country's largest and formerly strongest unions. Labor law has failed to protect workers, and government acts as a tool for the company. Corporations breach labor laws and are not held accountable. Union strikers are arrested and heavily fined. The bitter assault by government and industry has crippled union power to such an extent that unions are unable to gain significant wage raises or protect the jobs of hundreds of thousands who are sacrifices to company mismanagement, downsizing, or divestiture as a result of incessant corporate Wall Street-inspired takeovers and mergers. The American labor movement succumbed to its own success and the long-savored revenge of the bosses it temporarily trumped. The power labor gained was immense, was bitterly won and carelessly lost. When the Reagan administration chose to attack in the early 1980s by breaking a strike by aircraft controllers and forever banning the strikers from government work, it was aware the labor movement was weak and unable to resist a savage campaign of union busting. Unions were by then little more than huge bureaucracies. They had lost contact with their rank and file. Their leaders were raised to social levels with salaries plus perks, equal to executives of equal rank. Dissent was usually squelched within the locals, while union and corporate officials colluded on the same class level. For members of most unions, mandatory dues were and remain a tax on their wages at the same time they were denied meaningful or coherent representation. The corporate class bitterly resented the labor movement's power and exacted savage revenge throughout the Reagan-Bush senior years, attacking unions in their shops like wolves circling downed beasts. The older industrial unions were ripped apart. Thousands of workers were forced to take huge pay cuts and the loss of medical and insurance benefits to keep their jobs in industries that were crippled, dismantled, or sold off. Many thousands more were laid off when plants closed or relocated to the Third World. Communities that depended on smokestack or sold off industries paid huge ransoms of public money to keep them operating or to attract newer ones. Top echelons of corporations dismantled their subsidiaries to protect their headquarters bastions from corporate raiders, in the meantime feeding on each other in a frenzy of takeovers. Their unions gutted and powerless to protect them, American workers were pawns and generally losers in the bloody corporate wars. Disinherited at the same time, American corporations employed foreign labor to make their products at cheaper cost. The new realities of world commerce aggravates the problems affecting American labor. American corporations subsidize cheaper labor and manufacturing costs in third world countries by ordering finished products from them instead of producing domestically, which adds not only to the imbalance of trade, but shrinks the number of jobs for American workers. Real work shifts overseas, where the only competition is in degrading wages and increasing production, especially among young women, reminiscent of U.S. sweatshops in the early part of the 20th century and more recently in the Pacific Southwest. As the American working force shrinks, the power of the already weakened unions is further eroded. Workers in need of work accept low-paying and non-union jobs and lose their rights and protection. Trotsky was right when he said that labor must be universal rather than national, because corporate industry is global. Jobs are cut in the USA and exported offshore to third world countries with non-existent or harassed labor movements. Violations of international workers' rights are used for competitive advantage by U.S. corporations that are searching the world for impoverished countries with low-wage workers, even employing slave and prison labor, while engaging in destroying labor movements and imprisoning or murdering labor leaders. Unions once were, in the words of Kurt Vonnegut, admirable instruments for extorting something like justice from employers. But labor is badly wounded, and its history is treated like pornography. Strikes are crippled with injunctions, and workers are denied government aid while on strike. Union busting has frightened union leaders into painful compromises, and binding agreements are torn up by management. The legal framework of the labor movement needs radical change. Political solutions in which workers' rights and union democracy in its broadest sense are guaranteed are necessary. A generous concept of labor democracy would give workers more rights, both in collective bargaining and law, and would allow them a voice in investment policy and in such matters as layoffs, plant shutdowns, takeovers, and in selection of top management. The tax code should be revised to credit companies that avoid layoffs in profitable times and give employees a stake in company policy, as well as good medical coverage and broad retraining opportunities. Workers' rights should be manifested in various ways that would prohibit employer interference in their decisions about organizational representations, which should include unions with only a minority of workers and mandate collective bargaining that leads to solid contracts. Radical changes in labor law must obviously be accompanied with wide involvement of women, Blacks, Asian, and Hispanic Americans, plus physically handicapped and mentally retarded workers, and should focus on a social crusade framed as an extension of American democracy instead of pressure group whining. A special effort should be made to recreate a social justice movement like civil rights in the 1960s. Such a sharply defined crusade would be an initial stage in educating and mobilizing union members. The next objective would be for these members to spread labor's gospel as far as possible in schools, churches, civic meetings, political caucuses. To bring strong political support into the labor movement, more workers need to be organized and be willing to risk and endure long-standing picket lines like Astoria Mechanics, who lost several years ago in Astoria, Oregon. rebirth of a robust labor movement requires enfranchising women and minorities, the rise of vigorous new leaders untainted by corruption, reversing the decline and increased costs of education, and most importantly, collective action and collective bargaining to halt labor's collapse in post-industrial America. Reestablishment of a union culture in the United States and radical reforms of union laws must be a primary goal for the good reason that labor and production are at the heart of economic and political health and survival. As the man said, unions are bad, but without them it's worse. That perception is all too apparent when thousands of workers lose their jobs. The discrepancy in wages and benefits between management and labor is obscene, and the people who have jobs are required to produce more for less pay with little or no job security. The first permanent national labor organization in the United States, the International Typographical Union, acknowledged at its first convention in 1850, quote, "It is useless for us to disguise from ourselves the fact that, under the present arrangement of things, there exists a perpetual antagonism between labor and capital, one side striving to sell their labor for as much, and the other striving to buy it for as little as they can." And that was Labor's Labor Lost, which I wrote, and at the time dedicated this article to Juanita Huebner, who at the time was once again fighting for the union. And now, again, what I wrote. And oh, by the way, that was from the October 2001 issue of the Times Eagle. And this one, Union Dues, is for the October 2002 Times Eagle. Labor Day is the second bookend of the silly season, the first being Memorial Day. Neither holiday means much anymore, although the first one will probably be gussied up to absolve and perpetuate the new harvest of war dead. Labor Day continues to decay because workers who produce the GNT are consistently undervalued, which originally forced them to unionize. I was president for 3 years of a small company union affiliated with a much larger parent union. I was not so much an activist president as I was a caretaker attempting to hold together an unpopular union that seldom had the support or participation of its rank and file. I represented a membership generally inactive and unhappy. They had to pay union dues on salaries barely above minimum wage, which the union was not very successful raising. I was president during two contract negotiations, and we did not score well with wage raises or benefits. Management stonewalled us with shrinking state social services budgets. 1 year, the rank and file rejected a contract in which they lost benefits but received no wage raises in exchange, nor cost of living. They accepted a second offering that did not raise wages but at least retained the earlier lost benefits. Of course, management awarded itself rather generous raises and benefits. I wrote a letter to the wage slaves I represented, admitting the union side of the table poorly negotiated the contract and suggested they vote it down. We gave away hard-won benefits hoping to raise wages at every level to compensate for the lack of cost of living adjustments, which did not occur. This year's contract talks demonstrated the power meager funding gives an employer, which spawns an iron fist, and managerial power is almost supreme as it dictates allocations of what it claims are sparse resources, and employee wages and rights are hammered as a result. Some of you believe the union is just another bureaucracy that takes money out of your paychecks. Most of you rarely attend union meetings or participate in decisions that affect you. Yet the union is your opportunity to have a voice and a measure of power over your working lives. The more so, the more you participate. You can choose to vote down this contract and demand we get you a better deal than we have, which we cannot guarantee unless you show management that you are actively involved to increase the union's strength and potency. Of much greater importance is that you take the power the union offers you to determine your working future. And that was a letter I wrote. At the end, both company and union engineered me out of job and union. The parent union did to me what I thought the company would do. It fired me. The company wished to be rid of me as a result of my union activities and to decertify the union entirely. The company spread poison among its employees about the union, claiming it prevented them from receiving wage raises the company was willing to give, and promised scabs promotion if they succeeded in ruining the little support the union had. The dues problem might have been my undoing with the parent union. My company union members were paid the least, making barely subsistence wages, yet our dues were equal those paid three times as much. I argued for progressive dues rates, but union solidarity among the general membership stopped at that point. One union official said progressive rates would put the burden on those paid the most instead of those least paid, and that seemed to be the clincher argument for the majority, whose dues would have been raised. A futile showdown over arbitration for a woman who was fired for an act she denied was my last act as company union president. I characterized my presidency as a tightrope act above two snake pits, company and parent union, and felt I was snagged in a Darwinian swamp of bureaucratic savagery. My small company union signifies much that beleaguers unions these days. Although grievously weakened and suffering a tremendous loss of political power as a result of savage union busting and massive layoffs begun during the Reagan years, claims that the labor movement is dead are exaggerated, and labor might actually be reviving because, as the man says, unions are bad, but without them, it is worse. The bottom line in union work is representing the rank and file. There is a tendency in unions, as in management and any other group, for power to flow to the top and for elected union officials to form a clique of sorts that distances itself from the rank and file, exacerbated by contact with paid union officials, whose business is generally with local union leadership instead of the membership. It does not matter whether a union officer likes or despises the rank and file. They pay dues to be adequately and fairly represented, whether they are active or a bunch of deadheads grousing about union dues extracted from their paychecks. And regardless if only three or four participate in elections, attend meetings, and act active, a union's job is to represent them all. Perhaps most of you are vague or do not particularly respond to what our ancestors considered necessary fundamentals for maintaining personal and political liberty, but erosions of them will eventually ruin your lives, I wrote in my letter to my former rank and file. Democracy is always in flux between those who wish to protect and enlarge it and those who reduce and confine it. We are in a period of severe decline of the personal and political rights of people who work for a living, which makes it imperative we understand what is at stake on the job and in the democracy at large. And that, again, was something I wrote, Union Dues. And before that, Labor's Labor Lost. And now, from the New York Times, by Corey Robin, The New Socialists. The argument against capitalism isn't that it makes us poor, it's that it makes us unfree. Throughout most of American history, the idea of socialism has been a hopeless, often vaguely defined dream. So distant were its prospects at mid-20th century, that the best definition Irving Howell and Louis Kosser, editors of the socialist periodical Dissent, could come up with in 1954 was this: socialism is the name of our desire. That may be changing. Public support for socialism is growing. Self-identified socialists like Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Rashida Tlaib are making inroads into the Democratic Party, which the political analyst Kevin Phillips once called the second most enthusiastic capitalist party, quote unquote, in the world. Membership in the Democratic Socialists of America is the largest socialist organization in the country, and it is skyrocketing, especially among young people. What explains this eruption, and what do we mean in 2018 when we talk about socialism? Some part of the story is pure accident. In 2016, Mr. Sanders made a strong bid for the Democratic presidential nomination. Far from hurting his candidacy, the socialism, quote unquote, label helped it. Sanders wasn't a liberal, a progressive, or even a Democrat. He was untainted by all the words and ways of politics as usual. Ironically, the fact that socialism was so long in exile now shields it from the toxic familiarities of American politics. Another part of the story is less accidental. Since the 1970s, American liberals have taken a right turn on the economy. They used to champion workers and unions, high taxes, redistribution, regulation, and public services. Now they lionize billionaires like Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg, deregulate wherever possible, steer clear of unions except at election time, and at least until recently, fight over how much to cut most people's taxes. Liberals, of course, argue that they are merely using market-friendly tools like tax cuts and deregulation to achieve things like equitable growth, expanded health care, and social justice, the same ends they always have pursued. For decades, left-leaning voters have gone along with that answer, even if they didn't like the results, for lack of an alternative. It took Bernie Sanders to convince them that if tax credits and insurance exchanges are the best liberals have to offer to men and women struggling to make stagnating wages pay for bills that skyrocket and debt that never dissipates, maybe socialism is worth a try. Socialism means different things to different people. For some, it conjures the Soviet Union and the Gulag. For others, Scandinavia and guaranteed income. But neither is the true vision of socialism. What the socialist seeks is freedom. Under capitalism, we are forced to enter the market just to live. The libertarian sees the market as synonymous with freedom. But socialists hear the market and think of the anxious parent, desperate not to offend the insurance representative on the phone, lest he decree that the policy she paid for doesn't cover her child's appendectomy. Under capitalism, we are forced to submit to the boss. Terrified of getting on his or her bad side, we bow and scrape, flatter and flirt, or worse, just to get that raise or make sure we don't get fired. The socialist argument against capitalism isn't that it makes us poor, it's that it makes us unfree. When my well-being depends upon your whim, when the basic needs of life compel submission to the market and subjugation at work, we live not in freedom but in domination. Socialists want to end that domination, to establish freedom from rule by the boss, from the need to smile for the sake of a sale, from the obligation to sell for the sake of survival. Listen to today's socialists, and you will hear less the language of poverty than of power. Bernie Sanders invokes the 1%. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speaks to and for the working class, not working people or working families, homey phrases meant to soften and soothe. The 1% and the working class are not economic descriptors. They are political accusations. They split society in two, declaring one side the illegitimate ruler of the other, one side the taker of the other's freedom, power, and promise. Walk the streets of Bushwick with a canvasser for Julia Salazar, the socialist candidate running to represent North Brooklyn in the New York State Senate. What you'll hear is that, unlike her opponent, Ms. Salazar doesn't take money from real estate developers. It's not just that she wants to declare her independence from rich donors. It's that in her district of strapped renters, landlords are the enemy. Compare that position to the pitch that Shomik Dutta, a Democratic Party fundraiser, gave to the Obama campaign in 2008. Quote, the Clinton network is going to take all the establishment donors. What the campaign needed was someone who understands the less established donors, the real estate developer folks. If that was yes, we can, the socialist answer is no, we won't. One of the reasons candidates like Ocasio-Cortez and Salazar speak the language of class so fluently is that it is central to their identities. Al Gore, John Kerry, and Hillary Clinton struggled to cobble together a credible self out of the many selves they'd presented over the years, trying to find a personal story to fit the political movement. Today's young candidates of the left tell a story of personal struggle that meshes with their political vision. Barack Obama did that, but where his story reinforced the myth of national identity and inclusion, the socialist story is one of capitalism and exclusion. how, as millennials struggling with low wages and high rents and looming debt, they and their generation are denied the promise of freedom. The stories of these candidates are socialist for another reason. They break with the nation state. The geographic references of Ms. Ocasio-Cortez or Ms. Fobb, who is running to represent Michigan's 13th district in Congress, are local rather than national, invoking the memory and outposts of American and European colonialism rather than the promise of the American dream. Ms. Tlaib speaks of her Palestinian heritage and the cause of Palestine by way of the African-American struggle for civil rights in Detroit, while Ocasio-Cortez draws circuits of debt linking the Bronx, where she lives, and Puerto Rico, where her mother was born. Mr. Obama's story had its Hawaiian as well as Indonesian and Kenyan chapters, but where his ended on a note of incorporation, the cosmopolitan wanderer coming home to America. Ocasio-Cortez isn't interested in that resolution. That refusal is also part of the socialist heritage. Arguably, the biggest boundary today's socialists are willing to cross is the two-party system. In their campaigns, the message is clear. It's not enough to criticize Donald Trump or the Republicans. The Democrats are also complicit in the rot of American life. And here the socialism of our moment meets up with the deepest currents of America, of the American past. Like the great transformative presidents, today's socialist candidates reach beyond the parties to target a malignant social form. For Abraham Lincoln, it was the slaveocracy. For Franklin Roosevelt, it was the economic royalists. The great realigners understood that any transformation of society requires a confrontation, not just with the opposition, but also with the political economy that underpins both parties. That's why realigners so often opt for a language that neither party speaks. For Lincoln in the 1850s, confronting the Whigs and the Democrats, that language was free labor. For leftists in the 2010s, confronting the Republicans and the Democrats, it's socialism. To critics in the mainstream and further to the left, that language can seem slippery. With their talk of Medicare for all or increasing the minimum wage, these socialist candidates sound like New Deal or Great Society liberals. There's not much discussion yet of classic socialist tenets like worker control or collective ownership of the means of production. And of course, there's overlap between what liberals and socialists call for. But even if liberals come to support single-payer health care, free college, more unions and higher wages, the divide between the two will remain. For liberals, these are policies to alleviate economic misery. For socialists, these are measures for emancipation, liberating men and women from the tyranny of the market and autocracy at work. Back in the 1930s, it was said that liberalism was freedom plus groceries. The socialist, by contrast, believes that making things free makes people free. It is also important to remember that the traffic between socialism and liberalism has always been wide. The 10-point program of Marx and Engels' Communist Manifesto included demands that are now boilerplate: universal public education, abolition of child labor, and a progressive income tax. It can take a lot of socialists to get a little liberalism. It was socialists in Europe, after all, who won the right to vote, freedom of speech, and parliamentary democracy. Given how timid and tepid American liberalism has become, when was the last time a Democratic president even called himself a liberal? It's not surprising that a more arresting term helps get the conversation going. Sometimes nudges need a nudge. Still, today, socialism is just getting started. It took Lincoln a decade, plus a civil war, and the decision of black slaves to defy their masters, rushing to join advancing Union troops, to come to the position that free labor meant immediate abolition. In magazines and on websites, in reading groups and party chapters, socialists are debating the next steps: state ownership of certain industries, worker councils and economic cooperatives, sovereign wealth funds. Once upon a time, such conversations were the subject of academic satire and science fiction. Now they are getting out to vote and driving campaigns. It's too soon to tell whether they will spill over into Congress, but events have a way of converting barroom chatter into legislative debate. Socialism is not journalists, intellectuals, or politicians armed with a policy agenda. As Marx and Engels understood, this was one of their core insights, what distinguished them from other socialist thinkers, ever ready with their blueprints. It is workers who get us there, who decide what and where there is. And that was The New Socialists by Corey Robin. This is Michael McCusker. Thanks and a tip of the hat to all who pledged to free Radio Pacific KMUN. And now, as with all promises, is the time to keep them. Apparently, the station raked in $45,000 in pledges to combat the 45th president. Happy Labor Day and the anniversary of the end of the first American Revolution, and that its quest for democracy never end. And remember the Wobblies. Quote, labor creates all wealth. To labor, all wealth rightfully belongs. Unquote.